Welcome to this Good Lit podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California. The Good Lit series brings literary and culinary luminaries to the podium. I'm Gina Bellaria, Director of Literary Events at the club. To learn more about our programs or become a member, go to commonwealthclub.org. To take part in a discussion about what you hear, blog at commonwealthlit.blogspot.com.
It always makes me a little disconcerting for me to do that, but today it makes me think of Rod Blagojevich. Anyway, on we go. Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Phil Bronstein, Executive Vice President and Editor-at-Large for the San Francisco Chronicle. This program is part of our Good Lit series, generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. Perhaps Mr. Osher will underwrite some journalism also. We'll talk about that. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our guest, former executive editor of the Washington Post and author of the new novel, Rules of the Game. There it is. Whoops. It's a tale of intrigue and corruption and cover-up at the highest levels of Washington, kind of like a Post investigation. I'd like to be able to say that I once asked Len for a job and he turned me down, but that's not true. But I do want to get this intro right because I don't want someone like Woodward coming after me. You know, when I think of Len Downey, I think of journalism Brahmin, because let's face it, particularly these days, there are really only a handful of papers that still have the staffs and the fortitude to do the big national stories that hold powerful people accountable. And the Washington Post is one of those, and it was Len Downey for 17 years as executive editor of the Post that made sure the paper kept on doing that. And even though he may look a little like he stepped out of a J. Crew catalog, Len comes from relatively... I'm asking the questions
okay.
here. Len comes from relatively humble origins. He grew up in Cleveland, not Washington or New York, and he graduated from Ohio State. He once said that he got an apprenticeship at the Post in 64. He probably couldn't have gotten one today. I suspect that's not true, but he joined the Post as a summer intern in 64 and never left. As assistant managing editor, he was instrumental in the paper's Watergate coverage, and when he stepped into the big shoes of story editor Ben Bradley, if I can say that right, to run the place in 1991, what he may have lacked in some degree of Ben's flamboyance, he certainly made up for in journalism. The paper won 25 Pulitzers under Len's guidance, broke countless stories of great public service like the Walter Reed hospital scandal and secret overseas CIA prisons. And despite the fact that he has a hairstyle that's a little Blagojevich-y, Len is known even among the sometimes slightly self-righteous and arrogant journalism elite as an editor with incredible integrity. In fact, he famously said he never voted and even says he never held a political opinion in the name of objectivity. I certainly want to ask him about that. Last March, he retired as a Post editor and is now a Washington Post company vice president, upstairs somewhere in that building. And he's writing, after having written several nonfiction books, he's published a novel. So it is my great pleasure to welcome, and please join me in welcoming Len Downey.
Thank you.
I can throw these away. So, maybe I'm personally curious about this, but where did you find the time to write a novel? I mean, this is a really big novel with a lot of suspense and a lot of action, a lot of characters. When did you find the time?
Well, it took a long time. I started about 6 years ago, and it was my hobby instead of playing golf or something else. So when I did have spare time, I worked on the novel. My wife was very kind to me that sometimes that would be what little free time I had at home I was spending in front of the computer working on this book.
Now, the editor, the big editor in the book.
Yes.
Was it golf that he did at St. Albans, or he does something, right?
More likely tennis.
Tennis.
The one character in the book who's based on a real life person is the editor of the newspaper, and that's clearly based on Ben Bradley.
Okay, so there's none of you in that.
Well, not in that particular editor. Now, I'm sort of divided up. Some of my traits appear in a variety of different characters in the book, both male and female, but it's not by design.
No, I should pursue that.
It's just I recognize that.
Len's wife said that's not true. Okay. maybe the only fib he tells here tonight. So let's get the depressing conversation out of the way first, so we can get back to the book. Journalism.
Yes.
Today, we both read something called Romanesco. Thank you, Jim Romanesco on Poynter Institute site, who basically has news of the press every day, and it might as well be black bordered because it's very funereal. And today it was General Media lost $85 million in one quarter. The Washington Examiner is closing down, Baltimore Examiner is closing down. You have numerous newspaper companies in bankruptcy.
Right.
What is going to happen?
Well, clearly, we're in the middle of a very, very dramatic change in American journalism. And it's exciting on the one hand because the internet has given us all much larger audiences than we had before. Ways in which to present our journalism and do the research for our journalism in very exciting ways. But on the other hand, it's completely smashed the economic model for newspapers, as you know. Our advertising revenue is rapidly receding. Particularly the less glamorous but very important advertising revenue, classified ads, which obviously are much easier to use on the web and in some cases are free on Craigslist, and has taken all that revenue away from newspapers. The overhead costs of print newspapers remain very high. And in fact, because the newsprint companies have become a cartel, normally at times like this when revenue's down and circulation's down, newsprint would get cheap and that would save us, and that's not the case anymore. They're a more efficient cartel than the oil people. I'm not sure what's going to happen. There are universities that are beginning to get involved in trying to figure out what the future of journalism is, how to pay for news in the future. Foundations in some cases are funding experiments. Newspaper companies are reorganizing themselves, some more successfully than others. The Post has an advantage in that we're a diversified company, the largest holding of which is now an education company called Kaplan. And that gives some shelter to the newspaper as we go through this change. But there are newspaper companies that are going to disappear. There are cities that will not have metropolitan newspapers
anymore.
Do you
think that'll happen this year?
I think it could start happening this year. Well, Detroit, which has two newspapers and a joint operating agreement, has decided that they will only publish in print 3 days a week, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Right.
And that means that their home delivery base is essentially gone. You will no longer be a habit to go out to your doorstep in Detroit and pick up the newspaper. And to me, that's the beginning of the end.
You know, you mentioned Craigslist, and you and I were on a program a few Sundays ago,
yes.
Howie Kurtz, Reliable Sources, and you said Howie asked the question, why didn't you all, meaning major newspapers, start a Huffington Post or a Politico.com before Huffington Post and Politico? And your response was that the Washington Post website and the New York Times website and others are so much bigger than Politico or Huffington Post.
Right.
And I was a little concerned about that because I remember a conversation like that when a guy named Craig Newmark, I invited him to come to the Chronicle 7 or 8 years ago to talk to our website person to try and strike up some kind of, you know, partnership. And frankly, the then head of our website said, oh, we're much bigger than he is. You know, we'll kick his rear end and
right.
That'll be the end of
There's a difference there in that Craig Newmark is not really a journalistic organization. Craigslist is a business. And a very popular business because it is free to its customers and except for those people that are placing employment ads. And he has a very small staff because he doesn't cover the news. So that would have been a good partnership to get in with Craig, who's a friend of mine, because he's really got something good going. But Huffington Post and the Politico are trying to be news organizations, and they're building large overheads. Politico in particular does a lot of original reporting. It has a large overhead. It is losing money all the time right now, and it's being funded by a television operator, and I don't know how long that'll continue, frankly. They have achieved a lot of audience on the web, but their total audience on the web during its political campaign, which was, you know, very, very large for a startup, was not as large as the increase in our audience for our political news on our website. So I don't think that would have necessarily been the right business for us to start de novo. But what we are doing on our website is creating niches on our own website of various kinds for different kinds of audiences about politics, about government in Washington, and we're starting some separate websites. They're very highly specialized about government. So I think that's the way we ought to be going, but we're still in search of the revenue for those sites that will pay for them in the long run.
Yeah, because you've spoken, as you have for several years, about audience. Yes. You know, we have a bigger –
we all have a bigger audience, but it's not being paid for.
It doesn't do us a whole lot of
good. Right, it's not paying for the news.
Well, you said when you retired that you were going to go upstairs, write books, and help people figure out how to help the newspaper business transition.
I'm going to try.
So have you figured out anything yet?
No, I'm in the reporting stage. I'm going back to my reporting roots, and I'm going to be spending this next year on a project for Columbia University, finding out what different news organizations are trying to do, what the new startups are trying to do, to see if any of these models look like they're promising ones for the future. And right now, I just don't know.
One of the things we were talking a little bit before we came up here about privately funded organizations.
Yes.
The biggest one that I'm aware of, at least most recently formed, is ProPublica. Which
they're nonprofits. Yeah.
Nonprofits. And I'm involved with the Center for Investigative Reporting in Berkeley, which is in the same circumstance. But it seems like there's some dangers in privately funded journalism, and I'm just wondering your thoughts about it.
Yes, because the funders, the people who donate the money, ProPublica has started with money was donated by the Sandler family, a husband and wife, who made a lot of money in a California savings and loan that was later sold to Wachovia. That's when they made all their money. And they've given Paul Steiger, a friend of ours, a lot of money to start this investigative reporting project in New York, and they've hired several dozen really good investigative reporters and editors to conduct investigative reporting and then give it free to newspapers and radio and television stations, which sounds like a great deal. But there are some big questions. One question, of course, is the funding itself. It turns out that the loans that the Sandler Savings and Loan made in order to make all that money when they sold their savings loan to Wachovia are not standing up now, and it's the reason why Wachovia, in turn, had to be sold to Wells Fargo. And so there have been some embarrassing questions asked about the Sandler family's stewardship of the savings and loan. And some of those questions are now being asked of Paul Steiger. You know, are you using their money to investigate what's going on in the financial community now or not? And so that's one of the worries. And then we don't know what do the Sandlers want for their money. What do they want investigated or not want investigated, even though they say they're standing at arm's length? Same thing with National Public Radio, for example. You hear these things, so-and-so is paying for environmental reporting on National Public Radio. Well, do those people have a position on how the environment ought to be dealt with? And if so, is that how they want their money used? The other problem is that when you're a small organization like that off on your own trying to do investigative reporting is where do your story ideas come from? Most of the best investigative reporting, in my experience, at the Washington Post has grown out of our beat reporting. Some of the things you cited, like Walter Reed and the CIA secret prisons, Watergate's a classic, where reporters who are on their beats came across something that then grew into a major story. Well, there are no beats and there's no regular daily audience for ProPublica, so they've got to dream things up out of their heads. Ideas may be good or may not be good. And in addition to that, when they come to somebody like the Post or the New York Times or the Chronicle or CBS News offering a story, we need to ask, where did that story come from? Who are your sources? Are we going to get sued? Right. If so, what's going to happen? And so that's another question I have about those projects.
Well, I mean, and a question I have about not just ProPublica, but about the Washington Post and frankly, the Chronicle and every other publication is how come we weren't writing stories several years ago about the impending collapse of the financial system?
Right. Well, I'm actually thinking I may be doing a little blog on our investigative part of our site at some point. So I'm looking into that for that blog. And the interesting and encouraging response is a lot of us were. Madoff was written about by a financial publication, I don't know, 6-7 years ago, raising questions, and everybody said, you know, that's not true. Don't worry about that. He's a great guy. Right. He's running NASDAQ. You know, he must be fine. And there were a lot of warnings, including a columnist for the Washington Post named Steve Pearlstein, who spent an entire year crusading against these mortgage loans that went bad at a time when everybody, including the people running the Fed and running the Treasury, said that's nonsense. There's nothing to worry about there. Well, he won the Pulitzer Prize for being clairvoyant or being a good reporter at the time. So the media actually, in this case, I don't think this is like before the Iraq War, where I think we did not do a very good job of questioning some of the rationale for the war before it started. I think in this case, the media was out front, but nobody cared. Nobody paid attention. Everybody was doing really well. Their 401ks were great. This must not be a problem.
So we have had, I mean, do you think that those failures like the Iraq War, the weapons of mass destruction, have contributed? It's not all technology that's creating these headaches for us. It's not all business models. Do you think that there's been a failure on our part to perhaps do some of the big stories Now, you know, you've excluded the financial collapse because people have been writing about it. But Iraq is a big example on people's mind. Do you think that there's been a failure on our part to do some of the things that we're responsible for doing to serve the public?
Well, you know, periodically that happens in the media because, you know, we aren't perfect like anybody else. And once the war began, I think the main reason why Americans were aware of a lot of the problems that occurred once the war began was because of the reporting of the media. You certainly didn't get that from the administration. They weren't telling you. But no, I don't think so. I think it is a huge technological shift that created a huge shift in audience and a huge shift in the economic model that's caused the big, you know, that is really bringing the media to its knees in terms of whether or not we're going to continue. Back in the days when we were fat and happy, the 50s and 60s and 70s, we missed stories too, and that didn't affect our profits at all. I mean, the newspaper companies were making 25% and 30% profits. The failure at that time was actually on the business side. The failure was to see that this technological change was coming. It was going to change our business model. And newsrooms contributed to that because we weren't bothering the business people to say, you know, what are you going to do for the future? And the owners of most newspaper companies were very happy to collect the 20, 25%, 30% profits without putting money into the R&D in which we may have come up with the technological advances rather than somebody else.
You know, in terms of sort of the integrity of our business, I mean, there's always been this wall between business and editorial. And, you know, you've been an upholder of that probably more than anyone else, certainly as much as anyone else. Do you think that a little of that's going to have to come down? Do you think, for instance, that journalists are going to have to do more pushing of their own material?
Absolutely.
More talking about the value of what it is they
do? Yes, it's already beginning to happen. You and I experienced it in when we had to reduce the size of our newsrooms in order to reduce the overhead for the newspaper. That was an unthinkable thing in the past. So we had to get involved in business. We had to understand what was the reason for this and was it really a valid thing to do. My successor, who's 20 years younger than I am, thank God, and came from the Wall Street Journal where he was very involved with the Internet, has a lot of really interesting business ideas. And I find that a lot of his business ideas, some of which we're putting into action, are way ahead of those on the business side. And so editors are going to have to do that. So the wall that remains has to be the wall that says the business decisions are not going to affect the integrity of the news. And you can do that. You can be involved in the business side of the newspaper and not have it affect the integrity of the news. So that when a big advertiser calls up and wants a story changed because they're going to pull their advertising, you still tell them no.
But as the editor of the Washington Post, would you have gone out, or if you were still the editor of the Washington Post, would you have gone out, for instance, and appeared before a group of advertisers? Maybe you did.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Talked about the product.
Oh, yeah.
Not selling the ad.
It's fine to talk about the news, and I did do that. I did that for years all across the country. It's fine to talk about as long as I'm not selling the advertising and as long as their desires as advertisers don't affect our coverage of the news. I learned this in a wonderful way, a kind of scary but wonderful way, when I was a young investigative reporter in the mid-1960s, late 1960s. I was working on a series of stories about savings and loans, which were then the big lenders for homes back then, before banks got more into that business in Washington, and a number of savings and loans that were run by prominent citizens and advertised heavily in the Post were making loans of the kind that we've now seen to members of the black community buying homes that they never could pay off. They were kind of tricky loans. And then they would take their houses back, resell them under those same bad conditions as somebody else and take them back again. I'm working on this, and I wasn't a very good writer, so I'm really laboring away at my writing. And Ben Bradley comes over to see me. And he says, "What are you working on, kid?" And I started to explain it in the same long-winded way I'm trying to explain it right now. And he's got a short attention span. He says, "Never mind. I just had all these guys in my office. They own all the savings and loans in town. And they said, if we publish what you're writing, they're going to take all their ads out of the paper." And I just, you know, froze. I could barely breathe until Ben finally said, "Just get it right, kid," and walked away. We published the series. They took all their ads out of the paper for an entire year, which cost the paper several million dollars at a time when several million dollars was a lot of money, and nobody said a word to me about it. The only reason I know that that's a fact, how much this cost, is I did a little investigative reporting to find out. But nobody named Graham, no Ben Bradley, nobody said anything about that being a problem.
You kind of wonder how much longer that's going to go on.
Well, I don't know.
You know, one of the things that you explore in your book a little bit, not a little bit, a lot, is sort of the cozy relationship that exists at the upper levels of journalism.
Right.
With government, with business, and so on and so forth. I remember a couple of years ago, you were at American Society of Newspaper Editors panel on the First Amendment. It was you and Bill Keller from the New York Times.
Why do you have to remember everything?
I don't remember everything. I couldn't remember Romanesco, which will really come back to haunt me. You were on this panel at Bill
yes.
Keller, so the two right. top newspaper editors in the country, and McLaughlin, the former head of the CIA, was there, was
yes.
a panelist.
Right.
And there was a guy from the former Justice Department, guy,
yes.
I can't remember which
mm-hmm.
one. And it was all very, reasonable, rational, chummy, let's just figure this First Amendment thing out, because at the time there was this huge assault
yes.
on the First Amendment by Attorney General Gonzalez in the Bush administration.
Right.
And I was sitting there in the audience, because I was there to do something that you may not approve of, but I was lobbying for the Shield Law.
Oh,
but,
I approve of that.
But more good, thank
yes.
you. But more significantly...
No, I mean, we were too.
But
yeah.
more significantly, I was trying to keep two reporters out of jail in the Balco case.
Yes.
Whose sources the government was going
right.
after. And I got to tell you that sitting there watching sort of the gentlemanly discourse and high-minded debate was not the experience I was having with the Justice Department,
right.
where people were unreasonable, unrelenting, passionate about their point of view,
right.
which is that the press should all go away and die.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, okay, well, I mean, Len, where's Len in all this? Because that's a nice conversation to have, but that wasn't my experience of reality.
Right. Well, the Shield Law and source protection had not come up, or maybe we would have had a stronger disagreement. What did come up was, when do you publish things that the government says are national security risks? And McLaughlin and I actually disagreed about that, but it didn't matter that we disagreed about it, because I had already made a decision
right.
to publish the stories. And there was a lot of toughness of the kind you're talking about going on behind closed doors involving the President of the United States and the head of the CIA in several meetings, some of which I stole from in the book and dramatized in a fictional way in the book. So that had gone on and the decision had already been made, and McLaughlin did make clear in that panel discussion, in his nice, civilized way, that he totally disagreed with it. And he said that what we had done actually had harmed the CIA and the fight against terrorism, which I don't believe, but I didn't have any need to berate him about it because we'd already published it.
You'd already won, in other words.
Yes.
You mentioned Ben Bradley, and I'm sure that was an interesting moment, that transition, because Bradley was such a larger-than-life personality. But the guy, I think, who you named as your managing editor, Mr. Kaiser,
yes.
made a comment at the time that I saw in a story that basically said you didn't have the charisma problem, meaning you didn't have any charisma. And I thought, with friends like that...
Kaiser's under the misimpression that he has charisma. That's why
I see.
He said
so he's
that.
A bad judge of charisma.
Yeah. And he's been my best friend for 45 years.
Right, but I don't think one would try and dispute the notion that Ben Bradley was a larger...
No, and in fact, Washingtonian, a city magazine in Washington with a large readership, wrote a profile of me at that time, the headline of which was, which I'll never forget, "Not Ben Bradley."
Well, I guess the 25 Pulitzers was a nice response for that. So, all right, as I said, we would get to the depressing stuff first, and now
yeah.
let's go to something, the greatest cure for depression, and that's sex. You were quoted as saying that the sex scene, writing in the sex scene in your book, was very awkward, and that your agent and editor agreed that it was awkwardly done.
Right. It's better now. That was in the early drafts.
But then I went through the book, and I pulled out these quotes. And I just want to ask you about these.
You're so mean.
She unhooked her bra, freeing her breasts. Okay. Well, that's okay, because that's the sex scene. And it didn't seem that awkward to me. But then you had all this other stuff. It's like a whole lot of references to women's bodies, mostly taut and toned. Sarah showed off the body she worked so hard for. Susan Cameron, who's a very important politician in the book, in a skirt that subtly highlighted her figure, or later in her long fitted gown, Kathleen Morgan's extraordinary expanse of her freckled bosom. Blonde and model thin was a description of someone else. Big boned woman, fleshy in the right places. What's this all about?
I describe what some of the men looked like, too.
I don't remember that.
My wife, who's sitting in the front row, said, "You got to put more sex in the book if you want it to sell." So I did my best.
Well, I'd be really tempted to bring her up here and ask her about it.
No, what I wanted this book to be was realistic. And I mean, it'd be a good yarn, but to be based in life. And as you said earlier, sex is important in life. And
right.
And what people look like and how people react to them vis-a-vis Sarah Palin, for example, is significant. So I tried to do it in a relatively elegant, subtle way, sprinkled throughout the book and not put you all together in one piece of paper.
I thought that just had more power.
I see.
Together.
Okay.
You know, speaking of Sarah Palin, I mean, did you sort of recognized, as did a lot of people, that she had a certain power?
Yes.
The image, power of the image.
Yes,
and,
she did.
I think that a lot of people seem to miss that. If you put the politics aside, right, which apparently you did all the time as the editor of the Post, that culturally they sort of missed the shift, that everybody was getting the Obama shift,
right,
the huge cultural shift, but not right, getting the Palin shift.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, well, let me ask you, do you watch any reality TV?
Not very much, no.
Do you think you're missing out on understanding and of an important aspect of culture? Because we can't afford to be snobbish.
I was going to say, if I was still running the newspaper, I would probably try harder to watch more reality TV than I do for exactly that reason, but I don't have to now.
So what do you watch, just for pleasure?
I watch sports, news,
no,
for
reality.
Heaven's sakes.
Do you watch any reality
shows? For a little while, I watched the one about the fashion thing, you know, that picks out the what's that called? Project Runway.
Project Runway.
I watched Project Runway for one year.
Wow. 1 year? I thought you were going to say a day.
I mean, Heidi, to come back to your previous question, Heidi Klum may have had something to do with that.
I see. Okay. Now, the book, Jack, even though I read the book, I'm going to quote from the jacket.
Okay.
It says the book is about business interests, politicians, and the press, and the morally ambiguous ways in which all three really work. So what is the morally ambiguous way that the press works? Or how is the press morally ambiguous?
We have rules, of course, and the politicians have rules, and people have rules in government, and you're supposed to observe those all the time. And sometimes you feel that something you're doing that you want to accomplish is so important that breaking a few rules along the way is okay. That happens. Sarah Page, who's the star of the book and young woman investigative reporter in Washington, breaks a few rules when she thinks it's necessary to get her story. We're all human beings, and there are temptations of sex, there are temptations of power, there are temptations of money. And sometimes, again, people who think that they're doing the right thing most of the time will still yield to temptation under the tremendous pressures that exist in Washington.
There are a lot of people succumbing in your book.
There are a lot of people succumbing in my book and every day in Washington. So for me, what fascinates me about Washington is, since people do break the rules pretty much all the time, is how seriously are they broken, to what end, and what are the consequences for it. And so nobody in the book is a completely bad rule breaker. There's something about their aims that are still worth considering. And the people who are the best people in the book still break the rules sometimes too.
Well, first of all, Sarah Page, the reporter you mentioned, who's the heroine sort of the book,
right,
certainly the main character, was having an affair with her editor. And she got promoted, and he got exiled to suburbia.
Right.
And first of all, I was trying to figure out if that would happen in real life.
Yes.
And she would get promoted for...
Yes, because he was the editor. He's the one, going back to the rules of a newsroom,
right,
you're not supposed to fraternize with the people that work for you. And so he's the greater rule breaker than she is.
So
she had one strike, but that's for him was a strikeout.
Okay, because I was less concerned about... I mean, I totally understood why he would get slapped.
Right.
But I didn't quite understand why she would get promoted for it.
She didn't really get promoted for it, as her editor explained. Her editor, the national political editor, was looking for, a woman to join his all-male political team and somebody who could do some investigating because he didn't think the people on his team were doing very good investigating. And so he took advantage of the opportunity that she was sort of available in the newsroom to grab her under these circumstances, which other people saw as a promotion.
Yeah, one of the members of his political team, a reporter named Mark, he was basically having sex instead of investigating, as far as I could tell.
Yes, that's true.
So you mentioned the rules. Let me ask you about a few of them.
He's the one. He's the one that's really fascinated by it.
At one point, yeah, but at least I admit it.
Yeah, right.
At one point, Sarah, the reporter, asked herself, what difference does it make where the information comes from or what a source's motives are as long as the story is right? Is that your view?
No. She was trying to figure out, Mark Daniels actually did get a scoop, but he got a scoop through what she felt was an improper relationship with somebody at first blush. And then she began to think about it. She thought, this is a really important story. Maybe it doesn't matter where it came from. But she's young and naive. That's what the book explores, her growth as a reporter, her learning about how to deal with these moral choices. But in fact, that's not right. If as an editor, I would have called into question somebody's motivations and their source's motivations, because among other things, that can sometimes lead to something that's wrong,
right,
if you don't look into it.
You know, she did seem to me naive at first, and
yes.
I mean, young reporter, not that surprising. But by the end of the book, and the time frame of the book is not that long, she was shockingly astute and sophisticated and manipulating all these
right.
major players. How did that happen?
Yes. Well, I have two words for that: Bob Woodward.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I watched him go through exactly that transformation from the beginning of Watergate to the end in a period of 2 years, or
yeah.
3 years, actually.
Interesting. How about
yeah.
Bernstein?
Bernstein remained the
Not
same.
Not so much.
Carl
yeah,
Bernstein.
I know Carl pretty well.
He was never naive. He was always manipulative.
In another part of the book,
and I love Carl.
Sarah calls someone, someone's health club pretending to be his assistant to
right.
get some information.
She broke the rule.
So that would not be an appropriate rule.
She was impersonating.
And yet another point, she says, stretching the truth but not too much is okay. She wanted to look at some files.
Right.
These are things that you would say are strikes at the Washington Post or any other newspaper.
Yes, although, you know, how you obtain information that's in documentary form is a little bit closer call. For instance, I remarked to a friend who came with us tonight who was in the green room with you and me that when you left the room to go to the men's room, you took your file with you so that I couldn't read your questions.
Well, I'm not that
stupid.
And
that's because, that's exactly, because both of us know that's how reporters work.
Right.
And if you had left your file, I would have read your questions.
You know,
that prompted me to tell a story there. When I was a young reporter covering District of Columbia affairs, and Lyndon Johnson was the president, he was very interested in the District of Columbia and helped it achieve some measure of home rule. He had a little press conference in the Oval Office for some of us local reporters one day. And as we were walking in, we were shown in a little too early. His back was to us, leaning over his desk, turning all the papers over. And he turned around and sort of somewhat sheepishly said, "This is so you can't read them."
Well, the green room story makes me feel better for two reasons. One, that I took my file.
Yes, right.
And two, that you would have looked at it. I just
right.
feel better that way. One of your characters in the book, and these are, you know, I'm using the book to get at questions about
yes.
the real life, as
right.
you did also. One of your characters says, Washington and Hollywood get off on each other.
Right.
Can you discuss that a little bit?
Well, it's
and I'm not asking this from a
right,
personal
saw it at the, you saw it. Right. You saw it at the inauguration. You saw all those Hollywood people who are just fascinated with the star power of politicians in Washington, and particularly Barack Obama at the moment. But that's not unique. Bill Clinton had the same effect on people, and on Hollywood people. And at the same time, so many Washington journalists want to be on television, jump at the chance to be extras in Hollywood movies. And there's just this relationship between the two. There's this mutual fascination with each other. Power on the one hand, celebrity on the other. And increasingly, power journalists are becoming celebrities. And increasingly, the celebrities are trying to get involved in power and influence politics and actually be players.
Like Bono.
Yes, like Bono. There's a very good example.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, so I'm assuming, did you try and discourage that at the Post when you were the editor? Because certainly
we had rules. Come back to rules. You had to have permission from your editor or the executive editor, if that was necessary, if it was bumped up the line, before you could make these kinds of public appearances. And if you were a reporter as opposed to a columnist and were appearing on television, as many did, you had to stick to the facts, and you couldn't express your personal opinions, even when people were trying to goad you into expressing your personal opinions.
Now, I've always been fascinated by your rule for yourself as the editor
yes.
of the Post, not voting, which I personally disagree with, but
right.
we're not going to waste anyone's
That's okay.
time debating that.
Right.
But then saying that you didn't have any political, you didn't allow yourself any political opinions, and I just had this image of you going around the newsroom going la 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 la.
No, in fact, I would listen to all the politics that was going on, and I was usually the guy who would say, "But have you thought about this on the other side of it?" You know, it's the questioning. It's the role that an editor has to be the devil's advocate constantly. And it's one that comes naturally to me. I'm an incredible skeptic. I don't believe anything that I see or hear until I've checked it out. It's that old thing about, you know, do you believe what your mother says? Well, if it checks out, yes, I do. But if it doesn't, I'm not sure that I do, which irritates my mother, by the way. And so we do have rules that everybody in the newsroom follows. You give up certain political rights to work for the Washington Post. This is the case with many other newspapers. You cannot work for political candidates. You cannot contribute to candidates or parties. You can't contribute to or work for any organization that lobbies Congress, which rules out a lot of organizations. You cannot march in demonstrations. You cannot sign petitions and that sort of thing. You can vote. But I went a step further when I became the final gatekeeper for what went into the Washington Post. I did not want to make up my mind who should be president of the United States or who should be mayor of Washington or whether we should raise
more
taxes.
But help me out with that, because I just can't. It's hard for me to grasp the notion that a guy who went to Ohio and not Harvard, but who rose
the Ohio State University.
The Ohio State. Sorry, yes. I lived in Ohio myself.
Right.
That person would not actually form an opinion about who should be president of the United States.
Yeah, not a firm opinion. No, I could always see other ways of looking at it. I could go through the pluses and minuses of John McCain and the pluses and minuses of Barack Obama till the cows come home, and then we present all the information to people and they vote, and that's the way that it ought to be.
Are you a Libra?
Now, when somebody lies to me, as has happened, like John Edwards recently lied to me, I get mad about it, and I guess I have an opinion that, well, this guy's a liar. But I try to keep my mind as open as I can.
Speaking of John Edwards, do you have a better opinion of the National Enquirer these days? Because,
I've always had a good opinion about the National Enquirer. In that case, they broke a story that none of the rest of us could get. Now, they have an advantage. They pay people, and I know that they paid somebody in this case, an insider.
Sure wasn't Edwards.
No, it wasn't Edwards. It was the insider, the guy who took the picture, But they do get their facts right. Their advantage is that they pay for it at times, and we have a rule against that, and so Sometimes they'll get something we won't get.
Now, going back to the book, here are some names of some of your characters, and it's always interesting how people choose the names of their characters.
Yeah.
Trent Tucker, Rush Ripley, Warner Wiley, Chris Collins. What is with the alliterative names thing?
I'm a novice novelist. And I'm still fascinated with alliteration. You'll find other kinds of alliteration in there, not involving names, too. So, again, those names were scattered through the book, but you've got me.
All right. Well, gotcha. What else can you
do? I'm going to work harder on it next time.
Post. Now, you said that the main editor, who was sort of an epigrammatic, gruff kind of guy, was based on Ben Bradley. But I think I saw a little bit of you in there, as you said, in other characters. But let me ask you about some of your other characters. Trent Tucker, who's a sort of consultant, lobbyist, et cetera, there has to have been a little Karl Rove in that character.
Certainly some of the things he engages in are reminiscent of Karl Rove. Now, Trent Tucker happens to be a Southerner, and so there's a little bit of Bill Clinton's guy.
Carville.
James Carville's in there in terms of mannerisms.
Do you help me with Romanesco? I help you with
Carville. That's right. Exactly. Thank you.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different lobbyists and consultants are in there. But I know Karl Rove. He's a neighbor. And I'm sure it's inescapable that there's some of him in there as well.
Now, another character is Susan Cameron. And I won't give away any of the plot, but she's a very important politician.
Yes.
She is a very calculating, I think mostly liberal politician.
Yes.
One of her big issues is health care. And her husband had an affair.
Yes.
Now, does that just sound like somebody we know?
Yeah, there's certainly elements of Hillary Clinton and Susan Cameron. There's no doubt about it.
Okay.
That was on my mind.
Warner Wiley.
And I should explain to everybody that Susan Cameron becoming president and becoming chosen before that as the surprising vice presidential choice, shocking the country, even though she was a very inexperienced senator, was written 5 years before Sarah Palin came on the scene, which was kind of eerie for me.
That is a little eerie. Warner Wiley, who was the vice president who ran against her predecessor for president, had a down-home address, in this case Missouri, but let's just say Texas.
Yeah.
Went to private schools and Ivy League college, and his first job he got from his dad.
Right.
Now,
there's a little bit of that.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
And you have retired General Carter Phillips, who is pretty much somewhat ambiguous in terms of, not pure evil, as no one is.
Right.
But really a dark force.
He's one of the darkest forces in the book.
Okay. Is there no Dick Cheney in there at all?
No, not really. That really was not on my mind. I had something else entirely on my mind, but not a human. He's completely made up, but for a purpose that the book makes clear.
Are you so? Jones is an interesting character. He's the key editor. Is there a little of you, and what part of you is in Jones?
There's a little bit of me in Jones, who's the national political editor, and a colleague of mine named Milton Coleman, who's worked with me for a very long time. And his size and mannerisms are like those of Jones, but a lot of what Jones does and says is more like me.
You know, I take it back about. I did read descriptions of men in there. And they were kind of also similar. I'm not similar to the women, but
yes, right.
You got a lot of big, burly, imposing guys.
That's
you got
true.
Runyon, a rangy man who loomed over his cluttered desk, and Ron Jones, a big, burly man who overwhelmed his desk. There's a lot of desk harassment going on there.
Right. Well, the desks are kind of small at the Washington Post.
In the book, you know, you talk about a poker game.
Yes.
That this guy Trent Tucker played in.
Yes.
He was Supreme Court justices, senators, congressmen,
yes.
big-time TV and print journalists.
Yes.
So there we get back to that cozy relationship.
Right, and that poker game existed in Washington.
And as did a couple
I know
of
who
other...
played in it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you want to say so here?
No.
Okay.
But it did include Supreme Court justices, politicians, and journalists. It did.
So I just want to get back to the sort of the cozy relationship. First of all, I mean, as legendary as Ben Bradley was and is...
Yes.
He had pretty cozy relationships with a lot of people.
Particularly with John Kennedy.
With John Kennedy. I mean, is that the kind of thing in this day and age that you would say if you were counseling him
yes.
and it were now, gee,
right.
Ben, that's not a good idea?
Yes. And Ben, I think Ben, in retrospect, sees the questions that are raised about that. But you have to remember that was a different time. That was a time when the relationships were far cozier than they are now, when you had well-known columnists literally writing speeches for presidents. And you had these kinds of very personal relationships between journalists and politicians. It was a time when nobody wrote about John Kennedy's womanizing. Nobody wrote about Lyndon Johnson's womanizing. Nobody wrote about the fact that Carl Albert was a drunk until he literally wrapped his car around a pole in Washington, and they had to write about it. And that's all different now. That we're in much different times now.
I have to ask you, when you talked about writing speeches for presidents,
yes,
or for politicians, journalists
yes.
writing speeches, here is a, let's see, a speech I think from, well, you'll tell me who this is from, but here's the speech. The American people expect their leaders to work together to protect our democracy from the threat of terrorism, to revive our economy, to educate our children, see if this sounds familiar, and to strengthen the safety net for the less fortunate. This is President Capehart.
Correct.
It's time to end the polarization of politics in Washington. It's time to replace ideological rigidity with pragmatic progress on the nation agenda. It's time to put the needs of all Americans ahead of the narrow interests of political parties.
Right.
Now, I know you wrote this book before the Obama inauguration.
Yes, before Obama was even a candidate, I
but,
wrote that
but,
speech.
But, you know, that so are we really just getting sort of the same speech over and over at these things, and some of them are just more inspiring delivery than others?
Perhaps. But I think the country was headed in that direction when I wrote that, even though if Obama was a candidate, it was very early on. I think it was even before he was a candidate. But there were politicians beginning to speak that way because that was what the country wanted.
Now, have you formed an opinion now that you're the retired editor
yes.
of the Washington Post?
Yes, I now can have opinions. Yes.
Okay, what is your opinion about how Barack Obama is doing so far?
I am impressed by the very new way in which he's communicating with the American people directly through the internet. This announcement yesterday or the day before that the all the spending in the stimulus package is going to be put on a website for everybody to see. That's obviously unprecedented, and that kind of openness is welcome. I'm impressed by the fact that he's put in the cabinet a number of strong people with their own constituencies. Which would normally be something a president wouldn't want to do so that everything could be controlled from the White House. You're not going to control Hillary Clinton from the White House. You're not going to control Tom Daschle from the White House. So clearly he's got the self-confidence that he's going to be able to reason with these people and arrive at a direction that they're all going to agree on, which new presidents often don't have. The big question for me, obviously, as a journalist, is how he's going to communicate with the news media, because the striking similarity between the way in which he controlled information during the campaign and to some extent has controlled his relationships with the press in his early days as president is exactly the way George Bush came to town at the beginning of his 8 years in office. And I'm going to watch to see if Obama is going to carry his openness to his dealings with the news media as well as his direct communications with the American people.
Here's an interesting question. Well, first of all, I wanted to ask you, before I get to this, about Bill Clinton, because
yes.
he was a big chunk of your life as executive editor of the Post was when he during his two terms as president. So now that you can say so, what's your opinion of Clinton? Bill Clinton.
Well, I'll tell you two things about that. One, what I is part of my assessment, but also what his relationship was with me. He clearly was one of the smartest people ever to be president of the United States, and knew everything about governing, absolutely everything. Sometimes to a boring extent. I mean, it was hard to get out of a room that he was in because he would just keep talking about the minutiae of government, and he had really interesting ideas, and he held open debates with the people that worked for him, and was influenced by, particularly later on after some of the early mistakes that he and Hillary made, he was very much influenced by what came out of these debates, sometimes to the point of not making decisions fast enough. He clearly is a flawed person personally. His desire to be loved, not to mention what went on with sex with him, definitely inhibited what he was able to do as president in his second term. He and Hillary never liked critical press coverage, despite the fact that they held themselves out publicly as being very open and affable with the media and everybody else. And so their relationship with me personally was a very, very rocky one. They got very, very angry with me during probably his entire second term. One of them had actually told people in the White House, who told one of our reporters, that they thought I was jealous of Ben Bradley because he brought down Richard Nixon. I guess they didn't realize I was involved as Watergate as I was.
Editors never get any credit at all.
And they felt that I wanted to force him to resign as my way of getting even with Ben Bradley.
If I guess which one it is, will you tell me?
No, I can't.
Okay, all right. Here's a question from the audience. Who is the Leonardo da Vinci of the Congress or Senate? That is, who's the brilliant thinker whose ideas I should be aware of?
That's a problem.
Right. Let's go back to journalism. Right. Then. Something cheery.
I don't see that. Let's put this in a very careful way. I don't see that kind of architecting going on in the leadership of the Congress right now. And I think that's actually an issue for Obama, because I think the Democratic leadership is relatively doctrinaire, party line kind of stuff, highly influenced by labor and other constituencies, and not as flexible as Obama is about how to find the best solutions to things. And the Republican leadership appears to be primarily interested in, how are they going to resuscitate the Republican Party in very partisan ways. And that's not what Obama has set out to do. So I see real conflicts between him and the leadership of Congress. It's really interesting that just about every day he meets with them one way or another. He goes up to the Hill. He brings them to the White House. Just the other night he had a cocktail party with them, and he's just trying every way he can. But I don't know if he has the partners in Congress that he needs.
Well, one of the partners that he has, whether he needs her or not, or she's useful or not, of course, is Nancy Pelosi.
Correct.
And in fact, the Bay Area has a really disproportionate number of representatives in powerful positions.
Right.
Now, aside from Ohio, you're pretty much a D.C. lifer. You came there as a very young man and
Correct.
Stayed there. But San Francisco Bay Area is everywhere, all over this book. San Francisco, Palo Alto, San Jose, Nob Hill, Pacific Union Club, Carmel, Monterey, Pebble Beach, Stanford. What's the connection here? You've obviously got an affection or something.
Yes, it's certainly an area that interests me. I've always enjoyed coming here, I wanted one of my children to go to Stanford, but they didn't do that. Finally, my daughter went to UC San Diego. That was the closest we got. But I think there's a lot of interesting aspects to the area. It's clearly an intelligent, well-educated area. And so a couple of my characters were rooted in this area for that reason. I think for them to be believable as who they were, this was a good area for them to come from.
Well, and it's a good area to be touting your book because, this is, I think, per capita the largest book buying and book reading community in the country. But you also, as a new author, and you're not a first-time author, but as a new novel author, are you concerned about? I mean, we're reading the same things about the publishing industry that we're reading about journalism.
Right. My only hope is that fiction buying is a little bit on the upswing, perhaps because it's an escape during a really difficult time. But this is a worrying time for authors. And just recently, in fact, the Authors Guild of America and some other organizations sued Google because Google wanted to, it made an offer to all the university libraries in the country, let us scan all your books and we will give you free all the online access to them, and which would have taken away, obviously, the copyright rights, essentially, of authors. Right. And out of that came a settlement, which has been somewhat helpful, I think, to the book industry, although I think the amount of money involved doesn't come near, you know, the amount of potential earning power for those books. But the same problems that, you know, with the economic model and the alternative ways of reading books that threatened the newspaper industry clearly threatened the book industry as well. It's hard to imagine a life with no books
or no
when we've had it for hundreds and hundreds of years since Gutenberg, or newspapers which we have for hundreds of years. I don't think that either one will disappear, but there do have to be new economic models, and we do have to harness the Internet and other technologies. You know, my book is available for sale on Kindle, and I'm happy about that. And I hope people will read it on Kindle as well as in hardback.
A question from the audience related. Should we keep reading newspapers, or should we switch to other media? I guess, you know, I want to hear your answer to that, but I guess if you're compelled to read your stuff online, that's where you're going to read it. That's part of the problem that we have in print.
Yes. I still believe that what's most important is obviously the news that we create, and in whatever form people read it is great. Obviously, if you're reading it mostly on the Internet, then our newspaper ads are not being read, and we're going to get less revenue from them, and there's more revenue from print ads than there is from Internet ads. But I think it's up to us to figure out how to deal with that economic problem. My concern is being able to finance the newsrooms that produce the news, and however you get it, whether it's on your iPod or on a computer screen or on a telephone or in print, it's all the same to me if we can figure out how we're going to pay for it.
Well, I mean, those two notions are related.
Yes,
how
of
you
course.
Get it and how
or
we
potentially
pay for
it. In conflict. Absolutely.
Well, they're related particularly because, I mean, let's say, I don't know what the budget of the Washington, the cost of putting out the Washington Post is, but let's say it's not
the
unreasonable.
The newsroom cost is over $100 million.
Right, but it's not unreasonable. There was a time here, I think, in San Francisco where the Chronicle was, it cost about $400 million to
right.
put it out.
Right.
But if you went online only, you would disappoint a lot of people, and there's a lot of print advertising
yes.
still out there.
Yes.
But, you know, that's kind of fallen off a cliff a little bit. If you went online only in a day, you would basically get rid of most of your costs. You would go from a $400 million expense to a $70 million
right.
expense. And that right there would change the business model
yes.
quite radically.
You certainly wouldn't have the cost of newsprint. You wouldn't have the cost of the printing presses and the manning of them, and you wouldn't have the distribution costs of delivering newspapers. But you still, I cannot yet see. Obviously, I'm going to study this much more closely during this coming year. But I at the moment, cannot yet see enough revenue coming in to still pay for that newsroom because that's still a very large part of the cost. And I'm more worried. I mean, we're going to figure it out at the Washington Post. The New York Times is somehow going to figure it out, even though I think they're a little bit at sea right now. Murdoch has rescued the Wall Street Journal, at least financially. Some of the big national news organizations that have national, international audiences online, we're going to figure out ways to make this work. What I'm really worried about are local newspapers, which the Post is in part, but not entirely. It's local newspaper maintaining a large enough newsroom for the kind of accountability journalism that's needed in every city and town in this country, that's what's really being threatened by this change, and that really worries me. So in many cities now, little Internet sites have been started up, in many cases by journalists who've been forced out of the traditional
right.
newsrooms, traditional newspapers, and it's going to be interesting to see how much of that coverage they can provide with much smaller staffs on the Internet without that overhead of a newspaper, and I'm worried they're not going to be able to reach that critical mass that really makes good journalism possible.
So maybe one solution is to see if you or someone can be what they like to call these days an aggregator
yes.
of all that local online reporting that
yes.
students and others and unemployed journalists
right.
are doing.
Right. Well,
maybe
they
patch together.
Yeah, well, and this sort of partnership's beginning to happen. I mean, we now are sharing content with the Baltimore Sun. They're going to use some of our national, international news. We're going to use their coverage of Baltimore sports teams, which have an audience in Washington, but we can no longer afford to cover. Eight largest newspapers in Ohio have now banded together to share their coverage of the state of Ohio, for example. So there's going to be a lot more of this. There used to be an anathema in newspapers. There were a lot of backward things that newspapers did in the past, and one of them was we can do it all ourselves. We're not going to share it with anybody else. And that was silly. As long as you still have editorial content over what goes into your newspaper, you can get some of the news from other places. So there's a lot of economies of scale that are still open to the industry that we've not seen in the past because we didn't have to. We were making such big product.
Yeah, I mean, some of those kind of rules and yes. practices were sort of what I like to call the high-minded disease of journalism.
Exactly.
And we're having to shift. You said that New York Times is a little at sea. I mean, I think that's putting it mildly. Their building's in hock.
Yes.
They announced today that they have $600 million. They don't have $600 million for their pension fund.
Right.
And they just got Mr. Slim in Mexico to give them a couple hundred million dollars.
Right.
Just to sort of afloat alone to like a little bit of a lifesaver, but
right.
not much. I mean, that sounds like more than at sea to me.
Yeah, of course. It's a huge business challenge, but I'm mindful of the long, long, long-term rivalry between the New York Times and the Washington Post. And when Ben Bradley said, after Watergate, A. Rosenthal, eat your heart out, I'm different than Ben.
Did he really say, eat your heart out? Was it more colorful than that?
It was more colorful
than
that.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
Another difference between Ben and me.
So do you? Well, let's see. Let's look at these quotes. So are you fearful, or obviously concerned, at least, that the New York Times will actually, as the Atlantic Monthly suggested, go out of business?
Yeah, that seems extreme to me because there's such there's still a big foundation for good journalism there. You know, they haven't really approached. If I were to give them advice, they haven't really approached a rationalization of their newsroom, for example, which produces a lot of great journalism but also has a lot of excess costs built into it. I think they're just going to have to get serious about some of these things that they've been too high-minded about in the past. We'll see if that works or not. The family controls the complete direction of the company, even though it's a public company, and now has some very large investors like this man from Mexico, who's put $250 million into them. And so I think there's some real governance issues facing them in the future too.
Well, it's gratifying, even though the Chronicle no longer really competes with the New York Times, and in some ways never did, obviously on that scale, but.
Right.
I'm glad to hear you say that the New York Times suffers from the higher calling disease. It just gives me a moment of gratification. You mentioned Google. You're someone who, as a reporter and an investigative reporter, and you got reporting in your blood, are probably naturally suspicious, as you should be, and skeptical about people who have a lot of power and influence.
Yes.
And Google kind of has this image of guys sitting around and drinking Diet Coke and playing dominoes and throwing darts and being brilliant engineers. But in fact, it's an incredibly powerful organization. Do you think that that we as a profession in journalism have looked at Google enough, other than as a potential savior?
No, I think as a potential savior or as our death knell. There's a lot of concern now. In fact, there's a group that's looking into how newspapers ought to relate to Google or not, and whether or not we ought to follow the publisher's route or not in dealing with Google. And certainly as we begin to examine, not begin, as we're deep into examining a lot of big American companies more thoroughly than we had before, as we realized that they were misrepresenting themselves, we'll have to look into Google as well and how it works. Yeah. Google's an interesting place because it has many different power centers. It's grown so large now. It's gone from a Silicon Valley startup where you could identify the couple people that really were running it. It now has a lot of power centers. And Eric Schmidt, who's the CEO of Google, says he really is worried about American journalism and wants to see how Google can help rather than harm it. But when you try to deal with Google in ways that maybe could help rather than harm, it's harder to get your point across.
I mean, we may be talking about the same comments that he made, but I think he also said, well, we have an ad selling relationship
right.
with them. That's about all we can do.
Right.
And that was
yes.
sort of he kind of
yes.
raised the hope and dismissed it at the same time.
That was his most recent comments at several gatherings, including one that we were at, in which he said it both personally to us and also to the whole group, that he wanted to find ways to do more. So I don't know if he's tried and finds it too hard or if this was an offhand remark, but it's something I want to explore.
What about the you talked about journalists going off and setting up their own websites, and that is happening very much here and everywhere else in every other major city. But there's a sort of a question that's quite, I think, quite significant for us, and that is, what is the pro-am relationship? So citizen journalism, first of all, I should add, just ask what you think about the notion of citizen journalism. I haven't quite seen it be successful anywhere yet. But probably those of us who are in the profession are a little more comfortable with the idea of some professional professionals having a relationship with the amateurs. Do you think that there's a possibility of a future there, and do you think that the pro-am relationship is an important one to figure
out? Well, first, as a very strong believer in the First Amendment, I really do believe anybody can be a journalist, anybody can provide information to other people. After all, our newspaper industry grew out of printers in the American colonies who each on their own were presenting journalism that was sometimes reliable, sometimes not, sometimes mostly opinion. Right. It's the very same things we all worry about blogs and the Internet now. They were the original bloggers. And I don't see anything wrong with that. And I see a symbiotic relationship between blogs, citizen journalists, and so on in the mainstream media because, first of all, they can bring information to us in a variety of ways that we can then verify or not verify for people, which is an important function. They also link to us all the time. They're connecting our audience to us through links on the Internet. Citizen journalism is one of these many faddish phrases that have been going through, you know, the Internet spawns these sort of fads. And it's not really terribly different than what we've been doing, you know, a long time ago. Newspapers have brought ordinary citizens in to tell, you know, tell editors and reporters what's going on in the community. We go fan out and interview them as part of our jobs. And this is just another way for citizens to provide information. Now, in its purest form, from an Internet point of view, the citizens actually edit the copy and put it up on the Internet themselves, and they don't deal with professionals at all. And so far, I haven't seen much good journalism grow out of that. But where there's been a relationship conducted by a newspaper or by an NPR station, for example, with a group of citizens about a particular project, sometimes it can produce good results. And certainly, when a calamity occurs and people are sending in their iPhone pictures and calling in with audio and talking live on CNN about what they saw when the plane landed on the river, Hudson River, that's very useful citizen journalism. So I think we just ought not categorize things too strictly. And right now we have to let all the flowers grow and see which ones are going to benefit us in the long run.
But you know the CNN I reports and those kinds of things, you know, it's a little bit passive. In other words, you know, you just give us your stuff
right.
and then go away, and we'll figure out whether
right.
we want to run
it
or not.
And I think we should be much more proactive than that. And I think we should be engaged with citizens who can provide us information. We should be leading them. We can be editing them. You know, it's the sort of thing we do on the business side with focus groups. You know, you want to start a new section in the paper or kill a section.
Right.
You go to a focus group of citizens and get what their reaction is. You can do the same thing in news gathering. We just have to be so much more imaginative than we've ever been before. We're a hidebound, tradition-oriented profession. And we just must open ourselves up to all the possibilities now or we're going to die.
This question is from the audience, but it's I was over at Berkeley a few weeks ago, and it's a question that everyone over there has, and I'm sure everyone at Stanford or wherever else, Ohio State, mm-hmm. and so on. What will incent journalists to be in or go into that essential field? What is going to motivate a journalist
right.
in this day and age, a student, to go into
right.
journalism?
It's really interesting and exciting that, for instance, when I was at Arizona State deciding to do some teaching there, how many really highly motivated, highly talented students are in journalism and want to do journalism and see lots of opportunities for themselves. It's different than when you and I started out, when it was newspaper or television and, you know, you got on a track and you expected to work like I did someplace for 44 years. That's not the way it's going to be now. Now you don't know if you're going to be on the air or online or both or working for a newspaper that's also online and on the air. But what they see is a lot of exciting possibilities for doing journalism in exciting new ways. And they're doing it. They're doing it in exciting new ways. They're taking their own video, which, you know, before you ask a Washington Post reporter 10 years ago, would you like to shoot some video? I mean, it would be like you were asking them, would you like to jump off the roof?
Right.
But now these kids, they want to do. In fact, I was the opening speaker this year for the new class at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism in New York. It gets some of the most elite journalism students from around the country. First of all, they had a huge class, no fall off. Very exciting kids and young people, some of whom had already been working for a while. And this year they started class. My speech was given this so-called starter speech 3 weeks earlier than usual because for 3 weeks before classes started, before it counted, they were expected to be there and learn how to do blogs, learn how to shoot video, learn how to do audio, learn how to do all these things that before all we had to do was type. They need to know all these things because, as Nick Lemon, the dean, said, we're not going to teach you that in journalism, you know, our journalism courses or the political science courses. courses we want you to take. Those just need to be the skills that all journalists must now have. And these young people take to that. It scares the hell out of, you know, people our age, but these young people take to that.
Well, you've also got journalism schools like John Levine at Northwestern who are integrating marketing departments and, to some extent, business departments. And
yeah, that's a different kettle of fish that makes me feel uncomfortable. And that's really going off in a direction away from journalism. And I'm distressed about journalism schools that either become just naval studiers. You know, how do people really communicate with each other? And, you know, how do you really read the news? And how does that affect you as a voter? That's fine academic stuff, but that's not going to produce good journalism in the future. But there are journalism schools, including Berkeley and USC in California, for example, and many others across the country that are involved in trying to figure out how you can harness this new technology and looking for the new economic models that are going to produce good journalism in the future. And that's where I'm interested in being.
Well, let's stop being so high-minded for a second here. Your book, Movies.
Yes.
I mean, it's just a thriller. It's a thriller based in Washington with all these compelling and characters in certain sexual circumstances and a lot of descriptive, you know,
yes,
phraseology and so
right.
forth.
Right.
But you must have been approached by now.
Well, I have an agent, obviously, and the agency that represents me has does movie things as well as book things, and so they'll be offering it. And I know some people in the business, and they may have an interest in it, but we'll see. I obviously would love that, but it's a long shot. Not that much fiction gets bought for movies, and then when it gets bought, not that many of that were bought get made. It's a long shot. But I had fun doing this. I hope people enjoy reading it, and that's at the moment great satisfaction for me.
We're just about out of time, but I want to ask you something really important. So, when it's made into a movie,
you of course could make that happen.
Who do you say? Who do you see? Those days are over. Who do you see playing Sarah? Thank God.
Yeah, that's a problem. People keep asking me who I see playing Sarah, and of course she's so young that I don't know all these young actresses. You know, she's even younger than the actresses that have been nominated for Academy Awards this year.
All right, how about General? What's his last name? The evil.
Yeah,
who's
I'm blocking.
Not Dick Cheney.
Yeah, I'm blocking out his name too.
If you're blocking out his name. I feel so much better. Well, who would play him? I mean, you know.
Well, Philip Seymour Hoffman could play him.
Oh, nice.
Yes.
Nicely done.
Yes.
All right. Well, we've reached the end. Unfortunately, this has been a lot of fun. I hope you've had fun sitting here watching us have fun. Our thanks to Len Downey, former executive editor of The Washington Post and author of The Rules of the Game. I heartily recommend it. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. This program is part of our GoodLit series, generously underwritten, still generously underwritten from before, by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm Phil Bronstein, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you very much. Len, thank you.
Thank you.